Translation, Dhritarashtra said, O Sanjaya, after my sons and the sons of Pandu assembled in the place of pilgrimage at Kurukshetra, desiring to fight, what did they do? Purport. Bhagavad Gita is the widely read theistic science summarized in the Gita Mahatmya, glorification of the Gita. There it is said that one should read Bhagavad Gita very scrutinizingly with the help of a person who is a devotee of Sri Krishna and try to understand it without personally motivated interpretations. The example of clear understanding is there in the Bhagavad Gita itself, in the way the teaching is understood by Arjuna, who heard the Gita directly from the Lord. If someone is fortunate enough to understand the Bhagavad Gita in that line of disciplinary succession, without motivated interpretations, then he surpasses all studies of Vedic wisdom and all scriptures of the world. One will find in the Bhagavad Gita all that is contained in other scriptures, but the reader will also find things which are not to be found elsewhere. That is the specific standard of the Gita. It is the perfect theistic science because it is directly spoken by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna. The topics discussed by Dhritarashtra and Sanjaya, as described in the Mahabharata, form the basic principle for this great philosophy. It is understood that this philosophy evolved on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, which is a sacred place of pilgrimage from the immemorial time of the Vedic age. It was spoken by the Lord when he was personally present on this planet for the guidance of mankind. The word Dharmachetra, a place where religious rituals are performed, is significant because on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, the Supreme Personality of Godhead was present on the side of Arjuna. Dhritarashtra, the father of the Kurus, was highly doubtful about the possibility of his son's ultimate victory. In his doubt, he inquired from his secretary, Sanjaya, what did they do? He was confident that both his sons and the sons of the younger brother Pandu were assembled in that field of Kurukshetra for a determined engagement of the war. Still, his inquiry is significant. He did not want a compromise between the cousins and brothers, and he wanted to be sure of the fate of his sons on the battlefield. Because the battle was arranged to be fought at Kurukshetra, which is mentioned elsewhere in the Vedas as a place of worship, even for the denizens of heaven, Dhritarashtra became very fearful about the influence of the holy place on the outcome of the battle. He knew very well that this would influence Arjuna and the sons of Pandu favorably, because by nature they were all virtuous. Sanjaya was a student of Vyas, and therefore, by the mercy of Vyas, Sanjaya was able to envision the battlefield of Kurukshetra even while he was in the room of Dhritarashtra. And so Dhritarashtra asked him about the situation on the battlefield. Both the Pandavas and the sons of Dhritarashtra belong to the same family, but Dhritarashtra's mind is disclosed herein. He deliberately claimed only his sons as Kurus, and he separated the sons of Pandu from the family heritage. One can thus understand the specific position of Dhritarashtra in his relationship with his nephews, the sons of Pandu. As in the paddy field, the unnecessary plants are taken out, so it is expected from the very beginning of these topics that in the religious field of Kurukshetra, where the father of religion, Sri Krishna, was present, the unwanted plants like Dhritarashtra's son Duryodhana and others would be wiped out, and the thoroughly religious persons headed by Yudhisthira would be established by the Lord. This is the significance of the words Dharma Chaitre and Kuru Chaitre, apart from the historical and Vedic importance. Translation again. Dhritarashtra said, O Sanjaya, after my sons and the sons of Pandu assembled in the place of pilgrimage at Kurukshetra, desiring to fight, what did they do? Om Ganatimirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Srivasati Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Hare. Bhagavad Gita is not armchair philosophy. It is an action book. And life is all about action. The question, Dhritarashtra, sitting in his palace, asked Sanjaya, his secretary, is all about action. That's the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita. Kim makurvata Sanjaya, what are they going to do? So from the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita, you are thrust into the inevitability of sentient existence. When you have conscious living entities, there must be action. So therefore, we should try to understand what is the best course of action. Bhagavad Gita applies to everyone in all times and in all places. Why? Because everyone acts. You all have experience of, even in this lifetime, that you can remember performing actions that brought you undesirable results and actions performed that, at least temporarily, brought you some good result. Action, that is the central point, which Bhagavad Gita highlights from the very beginning. How to act in the best way. This is a question that an intelligent human being is concerned with. What's the best kind of action for the best kind of result? Since I have to act. Or should I not worry about these things and just leave everything to whatever? No, Bhagavad Gita is the precise science of activity. Why act? And for what? And who are you anyway that's doing all the action? These are essential questions to be answered if there's going to be real happiness, real knowledge, real success. Now, you hear that Dhritarashtra has some worry. He's in his palace. He's not on the battlefield because he's blind. He has, as you know, acted in a very devious way. Or more particularly, he allowed his favorite son, Duryodhan, to act in a very devious, low way to illegally secure the kingdom. Dhritarashtra has a motivation. Motivation in bhakti yoga parlance means he had some ulterior desire. Motivation is a big thing when you're trying to understand bhakti, pure love and devotion. Right in the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the graduate study to Bhagavad Gita, you'll find motivation being spotlighted. Dharma projita kaitavota paramo namatsarana satam. Bhagavatam, from the very beginning, sweeps out any ulterior motivation, sweeps it away from pure love. We've explained how people like to talk about unconditional love, which is impossible to be expressed by a conditioned being. As long as we are bound by conditions, subject to conditions, we'll never be able to express unconditional love. The term simply becomes a dream that never comes in for a landing. Unconditional love is expressed by unconditioned souls. Unconditioned souls means they have no other motivation except the love supreme, love for Krishna. Never mind the conditions. The pure lovers of Krishna are beyond conditions. Material life is full of conditions. Everything you do is dependent on something else. What's the weather going to be like? Do I have enough money? How is my health? Will people appreciate? On and on and on it goes. Just the next time you have a plan and you're thinking of executing that plan, just make a list of all the conditions the plan is dependent on. And you'll see why this is a world of conditions, and those in this world are known as conditioned souls. So there's no way that such beings in such a place can express unconditional love. But that unconditional love is what the heart is longing for. The heart's longing for it, but because this world has so many conditions, what do we end up with instead of unconditional love? We end up with frustrated love. The frustration must be there because of the barriers put up by conditions. It is natural to long for unconditional love. That's the only thing that will really refresh the heart. That's the only thing that will really satisfy us. So there's nothing wrong in looking for that. But the problem is when we look for it in the wrong place, like looking for water in the desert. Now you may say, oh, but isn't that a little severe? There must be good loving somewhere. You'll get a temporary appearance of it. You'll get an impure presentation of it. You have to expect it's going to be impure because persons in this world are not pure. What is legitimate and what we should be focusing upon is the positive. Our longing for unconditional love is genuine. Simply, we're looking in the wrong place. If we can only seek the fulfillment of our genuine desire in the right way, that means looking in the right place. We were speaking about Dhritarashtra, his desire. I've got to hold on to political power, even though I've wrongly stolen the government. I've got to hold on to it because I want my boys to take over, not my nephews. He had cast out his nephews, who were the rightful heads of state. Why? Because Dhritarashtra was so attached to his own sons, even at the expense of his dear nephews. This is how the bodily conception of life works. You want the closer the body is to you, the more it's your own flesh and blood, the more you have a physical connection with that body, the more that you consider, at least for some time, this is my real self-interest. These particular bodies around me, that's what I got to consider as number one. Because of physical proximity, physical intimacy, blood relation. Or, a little more removed, we're of the same neighborhood, we're of the same people. Even we are the human beings. Therefore, we can live in this world, even though we're destroying it, making it unusable by other species. We are the human beings. So this is all the bodily conception of life. And Dhritarashtra, in this first verse of Bhagavad Gita, is showing you that's where he's at. Mamaka Pandavaschaiva. There's Mamaka, there's my boys. And then there are the others. This is the way it is when we identify with the body. We're always making these divisions. Material life is full of divisions based on temporary bodily labels. These are the men. These are the women. These are the young. These are the old. These are the Ukrainians. These are the Australians. These are the Canadians. These are the you're always dividing like that. And these are the human beings as opposed to other species. So this constant dividing according to who's closer to your motivated purposes. This is a normal part of materialite, and Dhritarashtra is showing that. I've got to hold on to political power at any cost. Even I'm acting dishonorably. I'm allowing my favorite son to be so dastardly and low. But what can be done? The power has to stay with our side of the family. Yet, Dhritarashtra has a worry. This battle is taking place at Kurukshetra, which is a Dharma Kshetra. It's a holy place due to the gatherings of saintly persons there since time immemorial. So, in other words, Dhritarashtra, he's concerned that I don't want any spooky religious vibrations interfering with the scene here. He's like a good scientist, you know. Let's not get into anything spiritual at this moment. Let's be practical. I want total mundane, total material consciousness here. And I'm worried. This is Kurukshetra, which is a Dharma Kshetra. I don't want any kind of non-material influences interfering with the outcome. I'm a bit wary. The other side, those Pandavas, my nephews, they're totally virtuous. And so it may be that the holy place where the battle is being fought, it might kind of resonate with persons of virtue. He wasn't worried about any effect upon his sons. He knew where they were at. But he was just worried that the Pandavas might become turbocharged due to the terrain. So you can see, on the one hand, he was spiritually aware. Yet on the other hand, he was repudiating all his spiritual intuition and insight because he was so attached to the power. His boys had to stay in the government, even though they had seized the government wrongly. So therefore, he's asking his secretary. They're both away from the battlefield. But, as you know, Sanjaya had the power of remote viewing. He could see and hear what was going on at the battlefield, even though he was not there. And so, with that mystic power given to him by Vyas, Sanjaya was repeating to his master, Dhritarashtra, what was going on. As you know, Dhritarashtra was not simply physically blind. He was also spiritually blind. That's why he allowed his son, who was such his favorite son, who was so inimical and so full of bad qualities. He gave free hand to such a son, which should not be done. The duty of parents, the duty of spiritual guides is to correct, to guide. And Dhritarashtra, he abandoned that fatherly duty just out of attachment. Let my boys do what they like. After all, why? Because they're my boys. I want my boys to have the power. He wanted to feel that elation that those who come directly from my seed, they are in charge. He didn't even mind that it involved the terrorization of his own nephews. Nephews, yes, but they're a bit removed in the bodily conception. Sons are more direct. The boys who come from the womb of my wife, it's more compact and intense bodily conception. You notice how in a material existence, we crave for that intensity of bodily conception. The closer the bodily conception, the more we think it's going to be intense. So that's what Dhritarashtra is showing here. Mamaka Pandavas Chaiva. there's these this other group, which is, okay, they're my nephews. They're related. They're the sons of my brother. But still, nothing beats the bodily relation of those coming from the womb of my wife. So this is what happens when we invest heavily in the flesh. We lose our intelligence. The bodily connection becomes paramount. So this is Dhritarashtra's motivation. He's not looking for what is right. He's looking for what makes sense to his bewildered vision. And therefore, all these problems are happening. Let us consider once again about action. We also are always in a situation of what are we going to do? The gift of genuine yoga is that it puts you in a position where you can be on top of your actions rather than be victimized by your actions. So many of you have that experience of your actions go out of control, meaning the mind's out of control, therefore what you do is out of control. You're not on top of your own life. You're not on top of your own lifestyle. It's just spinning out of control. That may happen due to one's own wild mind. It may happen due to bad association. In bad association, your mind starts to spin. It may happen to due to previous conditioning. There's so many factors there. Because there's so many factors that are influencing action, a bhakti yoga practitioner is very careful. But many times people think that by being careful, you're going to not be able to relish life. The idea is that the more carefree you are, the more pleasure will come your way. Yes, I know a good number of you are familiar with that concept. Happiness is achieved by being carefree. To achieve that carefree state, do whatever is necessary. Swallow whatever is necessary. Smoke whatever necessary, just to achieve that blessed state of being carefree. And then life can really happen. You want to be carefree. Just think of the term, carefree, free of care. Like care is a burden, it's a problem. Let's be carefree. Careful? No way. Carefree. Or let's be careful to be carefree. You don't want anyone around you who's going to inhibit your carefreeness. So therefore, you're careful to only associate with those who are in illusion. Let's be carefree together. Those are known as good friends. You're careful to only have good friends who encourage your being carefree. So, Bhagavad Gita is primed to teach you that carefulness leads you to pleasure. In fact, carefulness is a precursor to pleasure. It's not a drudgery to learn how to act for your real self-interest. So we have to constantly do battle with the lower self, which is always trying to get out of control. It's begging you. It's threatening you. Just set me free. Don't chain me up. You'll be repressed. You'll be miserable. Just set me free and you'll see. Yet you look at the world around you. Does everyone look so happy? Because practically everyone is letting their lower self be out of control. So what is it that makes things look one way when actually they're another way? The uncontrolled life seems to be painful. And the controlled life seems to be uptight and rigid. there's a powerful illusion at work. This illusion can only be penetrated by those who have proper spiritual training and knowledge. Otherwise, we'll be victimized again and again and again. Another way of looking at this conflict at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita is that Dhritarashtra and his sons, they were the incumbents. They were in power, illegally, ruthlessly, wrongly. So their idea was, look, don't rock the boat. Never mind how we got in power. We're in power. Just leave it at that. We're in power. They're out of power. Let's just get on with life. Why do we need any kind of adjustment? Why should we even admit that we did something wrong? We're in power, so everyone should just accept that and live happily ever after. What's all this talk about Dharma? What's right? The main thing is the situation is already like this, so why rock the boat? Why go through whole commotion? You may remember, even Krishna himself went as a peace messenger to tell Dhritarashtra and his sons, you know, this is not right what you're doing. It's illegal. Come on, come on. But they disregarded Krishna because they're so attached. This attachment is a necessary outcome of material activity. You cannot perform material activity without winding up being attached. The two are packaged together. So Dhritarashtra and his sons, they were attached. And therefore, they were defensive. Like, why are you trying to rock the boat? Things are fine the way they are. All right, so we took the power one way or another, but we're in power. Leave it at that. Why all these theological complications, philosophical complications? Those who have the power should keep the power. Those who don't, well, let them find something else to do. This is politics. The outs become the ins become the outs. It goes around and around, up and down. Just like everyone knows in New Zealand, after some years, people vote out one party, they vote in another party. A few years pass, and, you know, like just musical chairs. Everyone's hoping, yeah. Well, maybe if we change the government, it'll be better. Or, well, what the heck, there's nothing to lose. Change. So, in this way, I hope you can understand Dhritarashtra and company's way of thinking. Let's not get into intricacies. Let's just live life. Living life means leave well enough alone. Now the question should be asked, why upset all this? Actually, from an ordinary material point of view, Dhritarashtra's sons were competent administrators. When you look at things from a basic material point of view, they knew how to manage. They knew how to give protection. They were like a highly competent mafia. they could take care of business, you know, nicely. They could give protection nicely. The problem, though, was a simple problem: their motivation. And Krishna didn't like their motivation. They were very envious, and they're very jealous and very power lusty. So you might say, well, what's the big deal? Everyone's like that, you know. They were selfish, highly ambitious, yet they were materially competent. But their motivation was the problem. You see, Bhagavad Gita sets a high standard for government administration. Sometimes people wonder, why does Krishna want to upset all this? Why doesn't Krishna just leave well enough alone? Isn't this the way the world is? You know, there's always going to be some discrepancy. So why let a battle go on just because the wrong group had seized illegally the power of the government? Life was going on. So what's the problem? The problem is, how can you expect proper care of the citizens when the leaders are very selfishly motivated and have selfish ambition? They're envious and jealous. You might say, well, big deal. All politicians are like that. Why do we have to make such a fuss over that, you know? That's the way it is, you know? It's life. But Bhagavad Gita is on a different standard. Krishna wanted these guys out. He said, well, why? They were materially competent. But the concern of Bhagavad Gita is not simply material competence. It's that people have a chance to be truly happy. If the material competence is coming through persons who are envious and jealous, they actually can't take proper care of the citizens because there'll always be some selfish motivation. We'll get something for us and we'll give something to the people. It's like in governments these days, when politicians award some kind of construction or project contract, often they try to arrange, they get a little kickback under the table. We'll give your construction company this multi-million-dollar government contract if you do this for us and that for us. The standard of Bhagavad Gita is that the citizens will not get pure leadership, a pure government, when persons are in power who have these selfish, envious, jealous motivations. Because even though such persons may be competent, such leaders will always be somehow lining their own pockets because of this jealousy, this enviousness. In other words, you cannot expect honor among thieves. You know the example. Let's illegally grab the money, and then we'll go back to our hideout and divide it fairly. Krishna's not going for that. Krishna knows that thieves can't be honorable. We seize the government illegally, and then we'll be fair to all the citizens. Now, we're so foolish, we're used to such a low standard, we'll accept that. Well, anyway, the whole point is, am I getting what I want? Never mind really who's in charge. But once again, the standard of Bhagavad Gita is much higher. The people deserve the best leadership, and the Pandavas were the best leaders. They had virtue. So it's not just some routine political squabble or family feud. On the surface, it's like that. But in the depths, what you have going on is an issue of good governance. And Krishna is making the decision, finally. And you can't blame Krishna. Sometimes mundane persons accuse Krishna. You let this war go on. But Krishna did everything to stop it, even personally going to negotiate peace. But he was repudiated. And why should Krishna take the blame for bad governance? In other words, he's acting so that there is a proper government so that people will be governed properly. As Krishna says elsewhere in Bhagavad Gita, if he doesn't do this and there's ruination, he could be blamed. It's like a father who doesn't properly arrange for his children. He could be blamed. Utsideya ime loka, Krishna explains later in Bhagavad Gita. I have to exercise a protective interest in the world. Otherwise, I could be blamed. Even though I have nothing to achieve, I have no gains I want in the material world, still, I have to act. Otherwise, people could blame me. The father is not properly caring for the children. So for all these reasons of political science, the Battle of Kurukshetra had to be fought. And of course, as most of you know, it was not a battle that involved civilians, women, and children. Like war these days means first thing you go after, the women and children, make their life hellish. That's part of war. No, it was fought in a remote place. Civilians were not involved. The political combatants would go off and sort themselves out, and the general people wouldn't be harmed. Whoever emerged victorious, the people would accept as the government. But Krishna has an interest. How his parts and parcels can receive the best possible governance. Therefore, Krishna was not tolerating the Kauravas, Dhritarashtra, and his sons. They were materially ambitious. They were jealous. They were envious. There's no way that they were going to give pure protection to the people. They would give some protection while lining their own pockets, and they already had done that. They had seized the government illegally. They had tried to exterminate the Pandavas through so many illegal methods. Tried to kill them in so many ways. So finally, when there was no other recourse, this battle of Kurukshetra is happening. And now Dhritarashtra is worried about the place of the battle. He wants, you know, to make sure everything is orchestrated properly so that the outcome will be favorable to his sons. But he's pious enough to know that this Kurukshetra, I'm worried about it. It's a Dharma Kshetra. It's a place associated with sadhus and yajnas, ritualistic sacrifices and spiritual energy. And I know all that stuff exists, but I don't want it impacting on this highly practical event here, which is meant to accomplish my purposes. We all go through our crises in life. Life in this world, in case you haven't noticed, is a crisis. We are trying to survive physically, and we're trying to get happiness. And there's always a crisis about that. Things just don't come together enough to keep us happy and satisfied. So therefore, we make alliances. This is a natural human propensity that is described in the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Deha patra kalatra dishu atma sanyesha satsupi tesham pramato nidanam pashyannapi napashyati. You make alliances because you feel weak. I can't be alone. I have to have allies. I can't be left on my own. I can't even deal with myself on my own. So I link up with family members, friends, lovers, neighbors, country persons, human beings. Let us link so we become stronger. But as Srimad Bhagavatam points out, all these alliances, they're so suspect. They're dodgy. They'll fail you. The names that you read in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, which are to the novice, they may seem a little intimidating, though I was explaining that in today's globalist world, encountering exotic names is no longer a rarity. People are in contact with names from all over the world, and so there's no need to be put off by the foreign-sounding names in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Today's foreign-sounding names become tomorrow's common names. Just depends on the circumstances, which are always changing. If you look in the dictionary now, you'll find that words like Maya and Dharma and Karma are just accepted as, you know, they're in English dictionaries, not italicized. They're just considered, you know, words that English-speaking people use. Whereas when I began my bhakti yoga practice in the 70s, oh, there's no question of such words being so commonplace. Now even a word like Maya is commonplace. So we should not be intimidated by the exotic appearing names, especially because if you plan to go deeper in your bhakti studies, you're going to meet those names in other places. Another reason why you have those names there is so that you can see firsthand the intricacy of this family affair. It's problematic. All these persons, they're related as relatives in an extended clan, or as friends, or as teacher-student. So if you know the history of all these names, you'll see, wow, what a mess. Everyone's related to everyone. Everyone's connected to everyone. Why? How did this scene happen? Well, how did this scene happen? Because of selfishness. The things that we might consider today to be so innocent, well, a little bit of selfishness will do you no harm. A little bit of personal ambition. What's the big deal, you know? All right, so these princes in power were, you know, self-serving and kind of lining their pockets a bit, but they were also doing something for the people. Anyway, what do you expect? And this is the way we think these days. It was such a mess. That's why Arjuna reacted in such a way. You'll find out later. What a problem. This is just a total snarl. This is just like this is a complete mess. I think I'll just go off to the forest. So we all come across situations in which we just feel like pulling our own hair. Like, who can solve this? Everything is intricate. And you practically just want to just check out. I've had enough of this. Someone just make some kind of portal where I can just walk through and I'm out of this world. It's just too much. We will all be in situations like that. That's the nature of this world. You have to be very naive to think otherwise. Sooner or later, it happens. Sooner than later. In this way, Bhagavad Gita is relevant to everyone in all circumstances. In the first canto of Bhagavatam, it is stated that by Krishna's aiming his instructions at Arjuna, he has spoken to people in all times, all places, all circumstances. So what happens in this first chapter is that an external crisis leads to an internal breakdown. So this first chapter of Bhagavad Gita is very important because it's showing you an actual psychological breakdown or panic attack. The symptoms that Arjuna displays at the end of this chapter are all, they're like a classic panic attack that psychologists will recognize. None of his options look good. These are the excruciatingly painful situations that come our way in life. None of our options look good. As Arjuna says, whether I conquer them or they conquer me, it's all bad. So let's go back to these complicated, intricate relationships. As we said, that's why you have all these names in the first chapter, because as you get to know about these names by reading Srimad Bhagavatam, it's not so necessary that everyone has to study Mahabharata, but you'll get it in Srimad Bhagavatam. You'll see the intricacy of the relationships, how everyone is connected to everyone, and yet there's this huge war. So once again, Bhagavad Gita is teaching you that you can't depend on these kind of relationships as your ultimate mainstay. Everyone has to learn how to fly their own plane. And perhaps we are afraid of that. So therefore, Shukadeva Goswami points out, we surround ourselves with the fallible soldiers, alliances, because I'm afraid to fly my own plane. Anything but that. I don't want to be alone. I need some living entities around me to bounce things off of. Better to have people around you that you argue with than have no one around you. Still, the truth remains. We have to fly our own plane. So what we should do is establish alliances with persons who will help us to fly our own plane, not replace our own plane, because that's illusion. So in bhakti, we have friends. In bhakti, there's family. There's the bhakti society. But the whole purpose of those relationships is to help you fly your own plane. Because whether you're a man or a woman, that's what life is all about, if you want to face reality. So you might say then, why are most bhakti yoga practitioners, why are they married? Isn't marriage an opportunity that someone else is going to make you happy? As one householder, a grihasta, told me a few weeks ago, he had been married for 30 years. He said, the purpose of household life is not that you marry someone who's going to make you happy. The purpose is that you, through the marriage arrangement, you get a chance to find your own happiness. That's the purpose of all the ashrams, to give you a setting in which you can find your own happiness. So the idea that someone else is going to make you happy is an illusion. Even in bhakti married life. Bhakti married life presents a situation in which you can, in which man and woman can live together so that they can find their own happiness as an individual. A peaceful situation. That's the idea man's attracted to woman, woman's attracted to man. Okay, take one. Make a situation in which each one of you can find happiness for yourself. That's the purpose of the package. Not to look at the other person and say, all right, what are you going to do to make me happy? That's what it's all about. At last. Now that day has come. You are going to make me happy, right? Yes. You haven't made me happy. Why are you in this world? What have you done this week for me? Instead, and these are not my words, I'm speaking from one of my godbrothers who's married for almost 30 years. He said, no, the deal is you work together so that each one of you can fly your own plane better. And it's maybe a little hard to understand. Wait a minute. Huh? The whole point is you get this other person and you squeeze happiness out of that person, right? What do you mean, work together so I can fly my own plane? Who cares about that? It's like, you know, you've got an orange, you squeeze it. What's the mystery? It's like, I guess, maybe when you were a little kid and you didn't want to eat your vegetables and your mother told you, eat your vegetables so you'll be healthy. Health? They just don't, vegetables don't taste good. So you, in the same way, it might be considered, you think. Be with the other person so that each one of you can learn how to comfortably fly your own plane. I'm not in it for that. I'm in it for direct gratification. So, this first chapter of Bhagavad Gita is pointing out to us that relationships in this material world are a problem. And Arjuna is getting big problems from these relationships. Why do we have this tendency for relationships? And certainly relationships in bhakti are essential. We have this tendency for relationships because we're part of Krishna, and Krishna is all about relationships. As we sing in Jai Radha Madhava, Krishna is never alone. What big person, what powerful person is alone? A powerful person always has people around him or her. Similarly, Krishna is always surrounded with others. Whether the cowherd boys, the cowherd girls in Vrindavan or queens and others in Dwarka, he's always got countless devotees around him. Even as the super soul in your heart, Paramatma, Krishna's not alone. His associates are there too. He's never alone. That's a sign of opulence. That's a sign of wealth. So because we are part of Krishna, we don't want to be alone. We want to establish relationships. We have that same tendency. Janmadi asiyataha. The absolute truth is that from which everything emanates. So our psychology, our propensity to establish relationships of whatever type, friends, lovers, family, master, servant, employer, employee, that tendency is in us because we're part of Krishna. But Krishna's relationships are infallible. And our relationships, well, So, this first chapter of Bhagavad Gita is giving you that picture. It's a family affair. It's an affair involving former teachers and students, friends. And the result is that Arjuna is going to have a total breakdown. In classic psychological terms, a panic attack. He can't cope anymore. He's demonstrating that total breakdown for our benefit, to show us the ways of this world. Arjuna had heaps of friends, heaps of family members, and yet look what he's going through. That's why he's just devastated. He's like, this is unbelievable. All these family members, all these friends, all these former teachers and their former students, and oh, look what a mess. You all know that relationship problems can be the most excruciating problems. Maybe on par with political persecution or something like that. Just relationship problems. Oh, they're like a fire that burns in you and the fire can't be put out. When a friend has let you down, when there's dissonance, disagreement between spouses, the whole world just seems to be on fire. And that's what Arjuna is going through. So much that he's going to tell Krishna, I don't care if they win and I lose. I don't care. I want out of this scene. He's soft-hearted, whereas the other side, they're hell-bent on getting their way. And that's why Dhritarashtra is wanting to know from Sanjaya. Are they going to fight? They're not going to give up, are they? The holy place is not going to influence them and make them pacifists, huh? They're going to go for it. He's a little wary. It's a pious place. That could be an advantage for pious persons, not my sons, but pious persons could benefit and become surcharged by fighting in a pious place. I want complete secularism. I don't want any fuzzy-wuzzy, hocus-pocus spiritual influences going on here. It's not the time for that. It's the time for ruthless ambition, getting what you want. It's time for power plays. So that's how Bhagavad Gita begins. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much.